new path at the dinner, you know, the theater. In addition to Moses and Apple, why did Danny take the book to the kids of Jerry and Jessica Seinfeld, who Barrymore, Beyonce, and Jay-Z, and Rob Lowe?
You're leaving out all my regular
friends. You're like, you're friends too.
My favorite friends are no cooler than my high school friends, okay?
Is it to inspire kids? What?
I dedicated it to the kids that I grew. A lot of them are my godchildren. I dedicated.
You have a lot of godchildren.
I'm a very good present.
I want you as a god now.
For me, cooking is about, as I said, togetherness, and obviously my children are my life, and they're the reason that I cook, they're the reason that I enjoy my life, they've given my life incredible meaning, and all of the children in my life do that. You know, they bring incredible grounding and sweetness and delight, and I just thought it would be, I don't know, I love them all so much, and their parents, all of their parents are so important. So I thought it would be nice to dedicate the book to all the children that I love.
You really open up throughout the book with incredible pictures, very intimately, of Moses and Apple, yourself, your friends, in different places, from your home, all these incredible places. Tell us about some of these pictures. Did you take them? Where were some of these pictures taken? They were weaved into the book so beautifully. How do you decide to use, you know, great shots, which are, again, very, very personal, but you decided to share with the public?
I think, you know, I collaborated with an amazing team. I worked with them on my last book. The photographer's a woman called Gita Issachar, and she's just so magical, and I just trust her so much, and we had such a great experience on It's All Good that when I was doing It's All Easy, I wanted to work with her again, and she just is able to capture both food and moments and people, and I feel very relaxed around her, which is why I think you sense the intimacy in the photos. And my children were just lobbying hard to be in the book. You know, it's always a balance. I don't really want them in the public eye at all, but of course, you know, if they do something really cute, you end up posting on Instagram or, you know, so it's always a little bit of a balance. I want them to, you know, have a private life.
But there is a really interesting, nice element to the book when you talk about breakfast for children and all different types of stuff. You see them after eating a lot of these incredible recipes of tap and go and all types of other stuff. So tell me, when you have her walk, did you do specific photo shoots, or basically she would play the fly on the wall and she would just film you cooking, going out on a picnic, just going out hiking with your kids? How did it seem so natural when you read the book and see the
I would sort of be in the scenario and then she would shoot the picture. So, for example, we were in Hampstead Heath in London near our family house there, and we went off on the picnic, and then, you know, she shot us as we went, and they were playing in the trees, and we were by the lake, and then we sat down to eat. And, you know, sometimes she'd say, okay, stop for a minute, and so I can take a bunch of pictures of that, or hold it right there, let me get it from a different angle. So it was a little bit of both, but it was mostly her. More like a fly on the wall.
And just transitioning, how difficult is it when Moses and Apple, so since the book covers a lot of healthy eating and these incredible recipes, which we'll get into more shortly, how difficult is it when Moses and Apple go to birthday parties or friends' houses to eat healthy?
Oh, it's impossible.
So how do you get around it? Because we have, my wife and I haven't figured out how to get around it without kids. How do you do it when they go to birthday parties?
You just let them eat.
Okay, let them eat.
Of course. You've got to let them have cake and
but then it starts
Doritos and
doesn't start competing with a lot of the great conditioning, and I don't even like to use the word conditioning, but a lot of the great recipes and the way you're raising them. And once they start being exposed to unhealthy eating, or whatever you want to call it.
I think that you, the idea is to raise people that when they're older, they have a real understanding of what the world is as much as possible, and that they know themselves well, and they make whatever choices that they want to make. I don't believe that you should not let children have sugar or whatever. You know, it's important that the food that they eat at home is packed with nutrients and good for them, and organic when I can get it, and all of that stuff. But, you know, if you tell a kid, like, you can never eat an Oreo, I mean, first of all, that's cruel. Oreos are incredible. Or Malamar. Imagine never experiencing a Malamar. Or, you know, Coke. These are great things. These are great American things. And so it's just about a balance, really. I mean, I don't get hysterical about it. My mom was really strict with us when we were little about, you know, health food, and then I would go to friends' houses and raise the candy jar and stuff. You know, you gotta balance it up.
I was actually really impressed with the introduction that you and Thea do, and especially your introduction when you talk about these impossible standards that we set for ourselves in our everyday life and resetting the topic. Could you elaborate and tell us all about these impossible why it's so important to
be set
this topic that's been thrown
along in the
same
time. It's pretty nuts. You know, I started to kind of ruminate on it when I was writing the book, because most everybody in my life has this sense of hyper responsibility. You know, they have to,
but why?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. You know, I think it has a,
but we grew up, there was no email. I know it's sometimes from the Stone Age, but no email, none of this. And now people are just addicted to their iPhones or whatever.
Honestly, I think it has to do with a sociological and economic shift that's happening in the culture, which is that women are really empowered. And women can decide to be mothers and have careers. And also, you know, and I think it's an amazing thing for us, but then we keep piling on more responsibility. So we don't say, you know, I'm a mom and I have two kids and I have a full-time job. Like, I also better, you know, be on the parent committee of this, and I also better, you know, and I also have to, you know, have a girls' night, have all my friends over, have a meaningful discussion, and, you know, be in a book club. And it's almost like we can take that the possibilities that are available to us are not what they've ever been in the past. We can do anything, we can explore anything, we can be whoever we want to be. And then I think conversely that puts pressure on the men, because then they feel like they have to, you know, but I do think there is a danger in all of us thinking that we have to do so much and we have to do it all to such a high standard. I mean, I personally, at this point, you know, I've sort of been working so hard my whole life, and, you know, multitasking. It's like, I just want the Xanax and a glass of wine. Like, I want to lie down.
How do we talk about resetting the topic?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, we're in this process of discovering, and we're going to figure out how to do it, and hopefully, you know, our daughters will do it better than we are, and our sons, you know, they'll. But I think a great way to reset the compass is to remember the beauty of life, which is human relationships and, you know, the things that are real, love, food, music, you know, the things that really just, reset you and kind of ground you and shift that paradigm back.
I feel like the answer to
well, that too.
Is it possible to be delicious and quick?
Yes.
How?
It really just has to do with your ingredients. It's very, very possible. I mean, for me, some of the most delicious foods are the simplest. You know, just a beautiful, quick, easy salad, or just seared scallops with butter, or, you know, just simple.
You tend to avoid gluten and sugar. Why is it there?
Well, sugar, you know, have you seen that sugar film and all that kind of thing? Yeah, so you don't need me to tell you why sugar is bad. I think one of the reasons that we might be having trouble with gluten is the way we process the wheat. We use a very genetically modified wheat now in a lot of places, and also the way we process it. I was talking to an Italian doctor about this actually, and he was saying that in Italy, they let the wheat die in the field until it's all the way dry, and then they harvest it. And what we do in America now, it's recent, is we harvest the wheat, we cut it, and then we dehydrate it. And his hypothesis was that in the processing of the wheat, which is why in America we're having so much trouble digesting it now. Could be true, could not be true. Certain people have no problem with gluten whatsoever. I have no problem with it. And certain people like my son have a problem with skin eczema. So they don't know exactly why, but there are some theories about why.
You don't compromise on taste and quality in general. How did you choose these incredible 125 recipes?
Well, you know, it's really hard to write a cookbook.
Tell us about Thea, because she's a real interesting that you work with at Goop.
Yes, Thea is our food editor at Goop, and I love her a lot. She's really pregnant right now.
And how did you originally find her? Like, you and I, Parisian cafe, you like something?
No.
I want to hear the real story about your family.
We were sort of set up on a blind date. It's not really a good story, but when I was going to write this book, I really needed some help, someone to, when I cook, was writing stuff down, brainstorming recipes, testing recipes. Thea created a lot of the recipes. We really did it together. It was a really joint effort. And, the way that we worked is there's just tons of back and forth, tons of cooking, me testing her recipes, her testing my recipes, and we just had a really wonderful time cooking. She's an amazing girl.
And how long did you get into the kitchen with Thea?
Oh, all the time. God, during this book, we were in the kitchen all the time.
And 125, like, how did you decide to break it off into certain chapters? No, other stuff. How did you decide to structure it the way it is? It's like this interesting theme that, you know, runs
around. Yeah, I mean, we were very interested in this idea of making lunch and bringing it to work, you know, because that's what we do every day, and it's hard sometimes to, especially if your office is in one place and you're getting the same sandwich all the time, or if you're trying to pack your kids lunch and you want to be creative, and so we thought an on-the-go section would be really fun, you know, to have, and just easy food that you can make that was healthy and wonderful and bring it to work and there to go. And it's kind of the way that we live, you know, there's sort of an entertaining chapter, which is called Unexpected Guests, and there's something sweet at the end, and I can't remember, we were all just brainstorming names for the chapter. We wanted them to be a little bit unique and not just breakfast, lunch, dinner, snack, you know.
What does your friend Crystal Lord's email sign up phrase, keep easy, mean?
It means, she's Southern, and she's just this amazing girl who, again, hyper responsible, has three boys, has a career, is on every parent committee, on and on. For those of you who haven't read the introduction, you know, at the end of it, I just talk about Crystal, how I was so inspired by how she signed off on her email for trying to arrange a play date for our boys, or like grab a quick, like, mom, glass of wine, like, can you do Tuesday, can you do Thursday, I don't know. And she just says, like, keep easy. When you sit at night, like, just don't worry about it, you know? And, it's just such a nice phrase, and so, I don't know, I just thought of when I was writing the book, I knew what the title was going to be, and it's just a nice sentiment, like, go easy, economy feel.
Why do you consider breakfast the most important meal of the day, especially?
Well, that's to say.
I'm interested in what they tell you. What is Gwyneth's thing?
I mean, I'm a little bit hypocritical because I personally cannot wake up and eat. Like, I have coffee and then I can't eat first thing in the morning, but for my kids, I cannot take them to school unless they have something to eat. I mean, I think the reason that they say the most important meal of the day is because, you know, you're all fired up and ready to spend that energy. But I find it a difficult, you know, my daughter's a vegetarian and she won't eat any eggs, and my son doesn't like breakfast either, so I always try to really encourage him to eat, you know, before I get them out.
What does he like breakfast?
I think he's like me, you know, he asks for a coffee in the morning.
Tell me about on-the-go chapter.
As I kind of said, it's just a way to make food, and, you know, like, for example, if you're traveling or work or whatever, I really like to have food that I make, and I know what's in it, it's healthy, I know where it comes from, and so I just thought it would be a fun chapter to have in the book, you know, that idea of my tactics.
When you're in structure, you call it preparing food that happens. And I like the idea. Tell us a little more about that, because there's a great picture of Moses eating, I think,
So there are these sisters in London, Helmsley and Helmsley, and they have a cooking show and books, and they're beautiful young girls. They're gorgeous. And they have this. We work with them a lot. They have a spiralizer, which makes, like, I guess they're called noodles, which is noodles out of zucchini, almost like a fucking noodle.
Get back in your own stomping ground. You grew up. This is normal English.
Okay. anyway, these noodles turned out to be like the most amazing thing. We make pasta out of them, cacio pepe with them,
and what do you do to make it? What
it's a spiralizer. So you can just get it on Amazon and you sort of spiralize it and make noodles. And one of the things that we were inspired to do by Helmsley and Helmsley is do these noodle pots, which they do with noodles and regular noodles. But it's so genius. So what they do is they'll take a mason jar and they'll put seasonings and, you know, different things, and then you just take that to work, and then you pour boiling water in it at work, and then you have these beautiful soup. And so we did a bunch of those recipes as well, crediting them, of course, with the idea.
I think somebody's going to put meat on soups out of business.
I don't know. Those are much easier than the it's all easy.
Too much soup. Too much soup.
Yeah.
Maybe my favorite recipe in the book, amongst many, are the miso clam, pan dinette, and the Thai-style crab cake. Please describe this, these mouth-watering recipes for the audience, because I want to make everybody very, very hungry as they leave this theater tonight. It's like, you know, the world's not, you know, it's like every night when you basically watch it, you're watching television, like, they always have a commercial about some type of food, like 11 o'clock. The world comes upon me, you stomach hungry. So I want you to make us really hungry now about these three recipes, describing them, because they're incredible.
Okay, so Sanfanya is a French, it's basically like a meat one salad on a baguette. So you can find a beautiful French baguette, and then you basically put the ingredients of meatloaf on it, you know, mayonnaise, garlic, wanted if you want, tuna, beans, eggs, tomatoes, and it's just like a perfect French, you know, when I did a movie in France a long, long time ago, and that's when I first discovered it. Delicious thing ever.
And is that for one or two people? Because the picture in the book.
Picture looks like four people.
Exactly.
Which is like how big your sky is and how big your appetite is.
Tell us about some of the other things. The miso plan was one that I came up with when I first started to speak about this kind of elegant but very quick food, and they're really delicious. You just, you know, just a little bit of white miso, butter, sake, and you put your clams in and
let them, the sake boil and let the steam take off the lid, and it's just fragrant and gorgeous. It takes literally 10 minutes. And what was the third recipe?
Was the Thai style crab cake.
So I love crab cake. And then my first?
Where do you normally like crab?
Maryland crab is always great. Blue crab from Maryland is perfect crab cake material. And I love a good crab cake. And in my first book, I made this really delicious, not that healthy, because my son was obsessed with SpongeBob, and he was like, what's a Krabby Patty? And I don't know what a Krabby Patty is, but I'm going to make one. So it's very delicious. You know, it's got egg and fried and breadcrumbs and on a brioche bun and with yummy sauce. So I thought, well, I should make a crab cake for this book that's maybe not as, you know, dry or not, whatever. So it just has gorgeous Thai flavors in it, and lemongrass and garlic and shallots, and I mean, it's just a little bit of a twist on a crab cake.
Since Moses doesn't eat breakfast, does he do crab cakes instead?
He will do a bite of a crab cake. He, unfortunately, is
depressed of a bite.
I know. His sister is really, she is, I mean, she was born a vegetarian. She's not interested in anything that's not vegetarian.
So you didn't basically help her to become a vegetarian. So basically, she just did not like meat to start with.
No, never.
Or the help her.
No, she never liked it. She would never try it. If I gave it to her when she was little, she would spit it out. She came out like
that. And as we told that she doesn't even, that she's a vegetarian, did Moses become
no, thank God he'll eat some other things, but he gets suspicious of things that she'll be like, ew, what is that? I'll never forget, one time I was in London and I had gotten this beautiful organic free-range duck from the butcher, the local butcher, and he had butchered up, I was going to braise it and make great Chinese duck thing that I made. And it was in a plastic bag, and the duck was in there, and there was blood in the bag. And I'll never forget, she looked at the bag, and she was about probably like 3 years old, and she said to me, is that blood? And I was like, yeah, it's blood. And she was like, why are you going to eat that? And I was like, oh my gosh. So she's just, that's who she is. She just, you know, won't eat it. So it makes him a little bit more dubious
about food if he will try it. What should we do when hunger
kicks in every day for lunch? No, what is that? I call it pretzel o'clock. Tell me about picking me up. Okay, picking up is a good chapter. Just a little, you know, we have a lot of nice hot drinks in there. That's a great way to kind of, well,
well, the hunger, yeah, when it hits you at 4 o'clock, or some other people when, yeah, it hits them at 2 o'clock, tell us some of the stuff.
You know, my favorite pick-me-up is a matcha tea latte. You know, just take a little bit the dry, you know, matcha tea, it's the powder, Japanese green tea powder. And I make it, you know, I heat up some milk, regular milk or almond milk, and it's so satisfying. If I'm really feeling hungry, it kind of takes away those hunger things. Or, you know, avocado toast is a really good pick-me-up, too. I wrote about it a long time ago. We did 3 really cool versions for the book.
What type of pick-me-up snack or snack do you do for the kids when they get home from school?
Love chips and guacamole. That's the main thing.
So basically, every day, on one table when they, yeah, come home, is a big bowl of guac,
that's right,
and chips.
That's right. very healthy.
What type of chips do you use?
I use, you know, in California we have great corn chips. And so sometimes I'll go to the Mexican restaurant where they hand make them. And then there's a really delicious brand. There's something so neat. I've only seen it in LA called Pava Corn Chip, where they got like a little bit of soy sauce and lime juice on the corn chip. It's delicious.
Sounds like there should be a fusion. What do you serve when you have unexpected guests?
Well, it depends on what's in your fridge. But it's an unexpected guest chowder. You know, we kind of talk about what we can grow together. I mean, for me, honestly, in real life, when I have unexpected guests, I always make pasta because I always have it in the cupboard and I always put something in the fridge that I can turn into some kind of pasta and with salad or vegetable on the side.
There's one recipe you have, Singapore rice noodles.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Those were inspired by my trip to Singapore a year ago. And, I was with the cuisine in Singapore, and we speaking of crab and one of the famous Singapore crab and all that. Because the flavors in Singapore are really good, a little spicy and just simple. You know, the great thing about most Asian foods is that there's no dairy and there's no sugar, you can make gluten free with rice and stuff. They're really easy and delicious.
Tell us, you described more in that chapter about growing up and even the pleasure of life. How there's always these unexpected guests coming. Can you bring it back to your childhood? Tell us about it. How you're coming in now, the part of the culture, the lifestyle, everything.
Yeah.
Of your mom, dad, you, and what you do with those people now, especially parents.
You know, we've had people over when I was a kid. You know, my parents, my mom is an artist, my dad was an artist, but there was always like artists over and thinkers and activists, and I don't know, because so we had like a house of people, and my mom would be kind of trying to whip something up to eat, and my dad, every Sunday morning, he would make pancakes, and it became like this huge thing where my godparents and friends and parents and my friends and their parents, you know, their parents were coming over to pick up the kids from the people over, and they'd sit down on pancakes and make like massive pancakes. And so I just have that memory around the sort of joy of friends and, you know, people coming in and having that feeling of an open house and having a lot of warmth. And that's something that we are definitely trying to reduce as well.
Talking about future recipes, on your, you just got back, you just flew in basically from Peru. Tell us what interesting food and possible recipes that you were really impressed with that might be incorporated into a future Chinese cookbook, okay. And how is Machu Picchu?
Well, we actually started the trip in Argentina, where I absolutely love the food. This style of cooking on the side of the grill, the wood burning fire. And I actually went out to lunch with Francis Malden, who is an incredible mind and chef. And he took me to this hole-in-the-wall family-owned restaurant where everything came off that little griddle. And just, this is where you just think, like, ingredients, simple ingredients are so powerful. I mean, just a slice of squash that cooked so slow that it tastes like sugar and tomato and steak with a chimichurri and all is like one beautiful simple thing after the next. I had the most incredible food in Argentina. And Peru, the food was amazing. It was so different. I've never been to Peru. And all the ceviches and God, I went to this restaurant in Lima called Rafael, and they had arroz con taco, which is again stuff, but I guess it's a very famous Peruvian dish of rice and stuff. It was so exquisite. And it's just amazing to, you know, have incredible luck to be able to travel and child these different cuisines, and to answer your question, Monty Pichu was just, I mean, breathtaking and sort of revelation.
When Moses and Apple, they come in, were they able to take the opportunity?
Oh, yeah, they were fine. I was not fine. So I spent a whole, it was like I had a hangover and I didn't drink anything. Not the kind of hangover I like. So the first night I was sort of laid out with the altitude sickness, but then I adjusted and then my kids were absolutely fine and they were such great, they're great travelers and they just saw everything with such openness and enthusiasm. It was just beautiful. It was such a meaningful trip.
I think you, Jessica Alba, and also Martha Stewart a couple of times. Jessica Alba, as you know, the Army Company, and Martha Stewart, Army Media. Tell us why food is very special to you, and how is it different than these other companies?
Well, we're very different from the Army Company. I mean, they're really making these incredible toxic products, and they're a product company. I think we're more similar to Martha Stewart because we have, you know, we are now making our own toxic products, and we have a content business, and we have an ad sales business, so that's the same. I think what we're doing, what we do differently is we are sort of, we curate a lot of products, and the idea is that we're a contextual commerce company, so we are providing a story and the reason that we are making a choice, and then we're providing the choice as well, or a couple of choices to make. But those are both incredible businesses.
Do you think there'd be more, sorry, the present product, do you think there'd be more good products part of the portfolio in the future?
Yeah, there will be. We're very, very hard at work at Goop. You know, we are doing a lot, and as my CEO tells me, you know, like, can we stop doing so much? But I'm so passionate about what we're doing in our skincare. I worked for 14 months with the chemist to create, like, my six perfect products, and it's been so incredible to see the response, and I'm so proud of the products, and I've been working on apparel next, and so in September we're going to launch apparel.
There's this great dessert chapter that you have towards the end of the book, and you have one recipe, this great shake. When are you going to create an alternative to Starbucks or Jamba Juice that's for food and put them out of business, right?
Oh my gosh, I can't be another job. but I do think that the consumer wants a healthier, fast choice. And I think see that a lot. You know, I think there's an incredible company called Sweetgreen that's growing very, very fast. That, you know, it's fast food with this gorgeous salad bar with their organic, locally sourced ingredients. Hosanna Grace, another incredible chef from Spain, he's starting a chain called Beefsteak, which is a vegetarian, like beefsteak tomato. Same kind of thing. I think people want it. I think people are starting to understand that we are responsible for our health and wellness, and it's not going to be a pill that fixes us, you know, from the inside out. And everybody's really kind of tuning into the fact that nutrition is important, and really, you know, junk food every single day, during the day, and it's not making you feel good. And so I think as consumers, we're starting to shape the market.
Another country that you love the food and spent a year during high school in Spain. When did you do On the Road in Spain, a part two, another story with Mario, Mark, and Claudia?
Oh my God.
That's such a great, how many people here have seen On the Road in Spain? It seemed like the dream trip.
Yeah.
All of you are going with Mark and Mario, and you were going to go with Mark and Mario before you were having a great time with friends, and you're having great food in the course, and you're discovering parts of the country that Claudia didn't know, you didn't know, that Mario didn't know.
Yeah.
What is the next one happening?
I think that was it.
How did you know that? 10 or 12 episodes.
Yeah, it was just one-off. beautiful adventure.
I'm talking about on the film side, a very interesting individual, fascinating individual that I interviewed with Philip Seymour Hoffman, and he also came across very beautiful, very vulnerable, brilliant individual, but came across very vulnerable. What was your experience working with Philip on The Talented Mr. Ripley, one of my favorite films and many people's favorite films?
Thank you. I had an amazing experience working with Philip. I absolutely adored him, and he was just so brilliant as an actor, you know. I didn't know him deeply well as a person, but he just delighted me every day on set. He was a real genius. It was such a tragic day when he lost him.
What did you think when you read the script that David Fincher sent you for Seven, and you got to that end of it? What did you say when you got to that end?
Well, the script was a pretty traumatic read, I have to say. And then I read my part, and I was like, oh gosh, wow, head in a box, really. But then they were like, Brad Pitt's the co-star. I said, okay,
And tell us working with David and Brad on that film, because that film basically came out of no place. It was a huge film, and it was just hardcore. It was David Fincher's signature earlier in his career.
Yeah.
But tell us about that experience, because David knows how anybody that acts in his film says it's a great experience, but it's a tough experience.
You know, I didn't have an experience at all. I don't know if it was because it was really early in his career, but, he did maybe 5, 6 takes, 7 takes, and now you hear stories of doing 75 takes. That was just
enough. He hasn't asked you Stanley Kubrick.
Not when I was there. I nailed it, girl. 2 pages. But he was great. And what was so funny about doing that movie was I had no sense on the set that we were making this terribly scary horror movie.
You're not freaked out at all. Like,
no.
Having any trouble going to sleep at night, about waking up in the middle of the night.
No,
nothing.
No, it was a really nice experience. I love Morgan Freeman. I fell so in love with that man. And I got to do this amazing scene with him. It was one of my very first films. I mean, I was so lucky. I loved every minute of it.
When you see the first screening of the film, when you say to yourself, not only did it first, but you say to yourself, is the film that I just acted in? You get that such a relaxed experience?
Yes, it felt very different. I was like, oh, right, this is the most brutal movie ever made. it did not feel that way.
Another great director that you got to work with, Wes Anderson, on The Royal Tenenbaums. Incredible, many people's favorite Wes Anderson film amongst many. What was it like working, what was your experience like with Wes?
It was so unique and so specifically beautiful and...
In what way?
You know, it was incredible because he's the only person I had ever worked with or will ever work with where he had the whole film finished in his head before he starts. I mean, he tells you, okay, you're going to have coffee colored hair to here, threading it, and this is going to be your eye makeup, and this is your outfit. I mean, it's all drawn out. His brother Eric draws everything out, and you really just have to sort of fold yourself in. It's almost like it's an animated film and you just fold yourself into the character and just inhabit his world. And it's just so wonderful.
You bring any people that you knew in your life or based that character, you sitting in the bathroom smoking and different. It feels so real
is that character from any place in...
No, I think she was slightly mean as a teenager, a little bit disrespectful, but a lot more damaged than I was, I think. I was mean smoking as a teenager, and then, of course, I did a movie and started smoking again, and then I just quit again.
Tell us about Evan, and why did you never pick up a British accent living in London?
Because I'm from New York.
No,
you can't
let me sit on the water.
But you're making a thing with British accent. Thank you. Well, you know, luckily, when I went to go to Emma, it's amazing when I look back now. You know, I was 22 years old, and I went off to star in Beloved, English, St. Austin, all of it. And it's so funny, it wasn't until I was doing the press for that movie in England, and the English press were saying to me, why did you, you had to come over, and, why did you think you could do this? I mean, this is real footstuff, I didn't use that word. And then I thought to myself, oh shit, that was a big deal. It didn't even enter my mind. You know, it's like when you're young and stupid, and you think you can do anything. Luckily, I have pulled it off, but I love doing that movie. It was a great experience. I was exhausted. I worked 6 days a week, 18 hours a day, but it was worth it.
It just came out today that Barbara Streisand is going to adapt Gypsy to the silver screen. And you have an affinity for music and singing. Tell us about singing in film because of what you've done and being nominated.
Well, I really love singing. I grew up singing. And I love it when I can act in something and they let me sing in it. I mean, I never wanted to singer or record an album or anything, but I think all actors, kind of want to be singers, and all singers kind of want to be actors. And I did a movie called Country Strong about a country. Thank you. And in that case, I got to go make an album basically and really record songs, and I just loved it so much, and it was such a rewarding experience for. You know, they're doing something like Glee, where I got to sing in bands and play guitar, and I mean, that kind of experience is so full of joy, and so challenging because the community works so quickly. I really love singing, and I would say I think feel like the only way I could get pulled back to work right now at this point in my life would be if there was some kind of singing element to it.
Did you ever expect Iron Man to become one of the highest movies?
No.
What do you think it became so widely popular?
I think mostly because nobody was expecting it. I think, even Marvel, they didn't have high hopes for it at all.
Wait, those two things. Not having high hopes, and why did they not want to care Rob Downey Jr.? Because now they must be looking down on the kitchen show.
Well, they did hire him, so they're talking. So, I'm kidding. He had a terrible reputation. He was in jail, he was unemployable, he was literally uninsurable. And they didn't want him. Nobody wanted him. And John Favreau, who was directing it, had this idea. What if you made a superhero movie, but with real actors, with people who can do Shakespeare? What would that be like? And he wanted Robert. And he thought me crazy for Robert. And, Robert had screen test, and they said, this will never happen, John. Stop asking us. We are never proving this. Never, 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 never. And in the 11th hour, he was doing a screen test with another actor. And he said, listen, you guys paid this day anyway. We're here. I'm cousins with other actors. Can Robert just come test? No skin off your back whatsoever. And they were really annoyed with him. but they finally relented, and of course Robert came in and crushed it. And they hired him, and then they called me and said, would you come see Pepper Potts? And I was like, who is Pepper Potts? I'm talking about it, I'm breastfeeding my child. No. And they just, you know, John explained the kind of superhero movie that he wanted to make, with real moments and complication, and you know, Jeff Bridges was going to be in it, and so I said, all right, what the hell.
Because of Iron Man, Robert's become the highest paid president in Hollywood the last couple of years.
And I have not.
Jeff Bridges did that, Jeff Bridges that point. Why hasn't more been done in Hollywood for equal pay for women? And I think today, every day is another day. I think today is actually really important day. Equal pay for women. Why hasn't more been done over the years? And why has Hollywood, as all types of industry, been allowed to get away with it? I mean, wouldn't it be called discrimination? Somebody is getting paid half or a fraction of what somebody else is getting paid for the same exact job.
I mean, they get away with all kinds of things in this country, all kinds of discrimination. There's all kinds of injustice, and I mean, when you think about it, you know, you have families drinking water or poisoned with lead in Michigan. I don't even know where to start. I mean, the injustice there is like one neighborhood has clean water, the other neighborhood has water with lead. I mean, what do you even do with that? You know, so there's injustice everywhere. You know, in a perfect world, women and minorities would be paid the same as white men. We'll get there. We're getting there. We make good progress.
But what do you need to do that? Apple, my daughter, they grew up in a world where they get the same, they get paid the same amount of money as a man.
I think, you know, we just need to keep being as good as we can be and fulfill our potential as much as we can. And, you know, this is why women who achieve real power are the ones who can start to move the needle. And it's hard though, you know, it's like if women in Hollywood speak out about equal pay, then they experience backlash. And so it's tricky. It becomes a difficult thing to advocate for, I think.
Have you seen the creative but very funny skit that Tina Fey, Patricia Arquette, and Amy Schumer have done on equal pay for women? You should actually Google it.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the one with Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
I think that's the one.
Is that the one? The last possible day.
That's it. See, I can't say it. You're really the truth of your life. But it sounds better coming from you.
Very funny.
What is the last question? Walk us all through a typical day in the life of Gwyneth Paltrow. From the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep, we all have these incredible demands. You have more than most. Tell us, what is it?
I mean, these days, it's pretty routine. I get up at 6:30, I wake my kids up. Although now Apple, she is already shattered by the time I wake up, but she's very organized. And then I make some breakfast, and then I take them to school, and then I exercise, and then I go to my group office in Santa Monica, and I work very hard doing 10,000 million things, and sometimes I'll have to even try to read a script in the middle of all of that, and then I pick up my kids from the bus, and then I work some more from home while they do their after school activities, and then I make dinner, or they're basically making dinner, and I go out for dinner and meet a friend, and then I go to bed.
How does Gwyneth come down?
I take a bath every single night. Bath and alcohol.
Is it red wine or what much is alcohol?
I'm very partial to red wine. I'm very partial to a dirty vodka martini.
Ladies and gentlemen, on that note, please join me in a second. Gwyneth Paltrow.